will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
People said, well, don't sweat the small things. Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO and today's guest host.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another special edition of the Tough Things First podcast. This is something we're doing differently this year. Several times a year, we're going to have a special episode where we talk about the top three tough things that you as a business leader need to do for a specific topic. And today, we're going to talk about the tough things first that you need to do to build an enduring business. Now, what do we mean by enduring business? I'm going to cheat here because I took this from Ray Zinn's book, Tough Things First. And an enduring business is one that is not designed to be a bottle rocket. It's designed to be a hoist. It's designed to be steady, day in, day out, profitable for this generation, for the next generation, for the generation after that. And that's what Silicon Valley often avoids doing, is building enduring businesses. So we're going to talk with Ray Zinn, and we're going to get those top three things to build the enduring business. And on that note, hello, Ray. How are you?
Doing fine, Guy. Thanks for this opportunity to meet with you once again to talk about the top three tough things first that we need to do.
Well, and I think it's important for your audience to keep in mind that Ray is literally the longest serving CEO in Silicon Valley. I mean, he is a legend out there. The way that he started his company, the level of employee commitment to his company, as demonstrated by the low turnover rate and the number of people who left the company and then came running back because they discovered it really was a great place to work. All of this kind of fits into today's topic about the enduring business and Ray's advice as to how to do that. So let's jump right into that, Ray. Tell me what the number one aspect of building an enduring business is. What's the first thing every business leader needs to focus on?
Well, I'd like to go, just to go back a minute where you're talking about what is enduring. Enduring is the opposite of endearing. Enduring is, as you pointed out, it's like a hoist. It's sustainable. It doesn't fizzle out. Endearing, it's like the 4th of July fireworks. That looks great for about 20 minutes. Everything's all wonderful and you're all excited, and then it fizzles out. So, the enduring companies fizzle out. The enduring companies don't look glamorous in the sense of the word. They just look, they can take and sustain great loads for long periods of time. And so to do that, the first thing you got to do is make sure that when you start your business, if you're a startup, or even if you're in a company or a business that has been underway for a while, is to make sure you have enough cash to sustain yourself, that you're not just, here today, gone tomorrow. Sustain yourself means that you are profitable. And that means you have enough cash to take you to profitability. And so if you're, say, on net 30 days and your receivables, you have to be able to sustain yourself for 30 days because you're not going to get that cash for 30 days. And probably average is more like 50 to 60 days. So whether you're running a business or whether you're starting a business, you want to have enough cash to take you to profitability. In other words, the cash will last you. The reason I say that is because otherwise you're constantly going out there having to chase the almighty dollar to keep your company going. And so if you can't raise enough money to take you to profitability, or if you're an ongoing business and you can't make it to the next end of the month or next 50 to 60 days, don't do it. Just fold your tent. And so I would caution anyone who is either running a business or is considering going into a business, that if you can't sustain yourself until you're profitable, then you shouldn't be in business. And so that's the real key.
And oddly enough, that goes against a lot of the bad advice that you hear in Silicon Valley. The number of entrepreneurs I've seen who spend their first 5, maybe 6 years doing nothing but raising money, while internally their company becomes dysfunctional, unprofitable, almost internally antagonistic, everyone living on the pipe dream, but no one actually, you know, getting black ink on the bottom line, seems to me to be almost cause and effect. If you spend, as a business leader, if you spend all of your time out in the field raising money, you're doing absolutely nothing in the office to try to reach profitability.
Absolutely. And that's, I think that's the mistake that most companies make, is that, or startups make, is that, and by the way, why 90% of all startups don't last more than 3 years is because they're out there raising money rather than running their business.
And that gets me to one of my pet peeves, which is Uber. Uber has been around now for more than a decade. They're bleeding billions of dollars every year. The only way they've been able to sustain this is through investors throwing more and more money into it. And still to this day, they have no horizon that says this is the date that we will be profitable. At some point, this has to implode.
I know. Exactly. So, you know, you're not a real business or a real company if you're not profitable. Pure and simple. Profitability is sustainability. Anybody that tells you that they're running a company that doesn't have to be profitable, they're running a nonprofit organization, as you would, you know, they're not going to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of happening to Uber right now. You know, they kept expanding their mission statement. They kept adding on new businesses on the side, and now they're lopping them off like they're doing self-amputation. And I'm sure people can do self-amputation, but it's not pleasant.
Well, even nonprofit organizations, have to have the revenue that they bring in is greater than the expenses that are used to create the nonprofit. And so Uber's even worse than that. I mean, they spend more money than they take in. I call them breatharians, you know, I mean, they're living off of nothing. While I use Uber and they're a fine service, without making money, they die, you know, and if you wonder why, you know, Uber can run you around to your destination for about a third or half of what it costs you to take a taxi. Now you should understand you can't do that forever, because you're just going to lose, you're going to lose money. Those taxi cab companies that used to run you around for twice what you're currently paying at Uber or Lyft, they charge more money for a reason. Not that they're trying to be rich. They're just trying to be sustainable.
Right. Right. All right. So number one thing that a business leader needs to do to build an enduring company is to have enough cash to take them to profitability. What's number two on your list?
Well, you have to have an employee-centric business. You got to have happy employees. And going back to Uber, I take Uber all the time. I use Uber at least 2 or 3 times a month, or Lyft. Not just to talk about Uber, in talking with those drivers, I've never spoken to one of them that really likes the company. That really, you know, they're not employees. Of course, Uber calls them contractors. They're not employed. The drivers are not employees. And they looked at as contractors. And so they don't have any loyalty. They don't have any commitment to the company. And as I said, I take it all the time. I've never had the same driver. And I always ask them how they like driving for Uber or for Lyft. And they don't like it. I said, then why do you do it? Well, we don't have a choice. You know, they're all saying they don't have a choice and they need that extra money. And so they put up with the nonsense, but they're not going to be loyal. I would say the average Uber driver is probably less than 3 years. In other words, they don't stay with them very long. And so, if you don't have a loyal employee base, trust me, you're going to soon be out of business, and or you're going to constantly be rotating employees. So, having a good culture where the people say when you ask them, how do you like your company? They say, I love my company. And that's what keeps your employees there when they say they love it. They absolutely love it. And so I think that's a mistake that especially Uber makes to some degree Lyft, is that they really don't like their company.
And I've seen this in operation myself. Ages ago, I used to work at a Circuit City corporate headquarters, and they had a center of gravity with inside of the company, which was always reinforced in the house organ through the management chain, whatnot. But it was always about customer service. And this was before Best Buy came and Circuit City had a, CEO overhaul. But everyone was excited about the company because everyone held dear to that idea that we're here to make our customers happy. We always want them to feel like they got the right product, the right service, blah, 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 blah. And, they didn't pay exceptionally more than anyone else. They didn't have extravagant benefits, but boy, everyone showed up to work with a smile on their face and ready to do the best job that they could because they had a belief that, our core mission was something important.
Well, a happy employee is, you'll have a happy customer. I hate to keep going back to Uber, but I've never seen a happy Uber driver. Okay.
Yeah.
It's always gloom. Okay. If your employees are not happy, your customers are not going to be happy because they're the ones that are creating that product or service that you're providing. So you absolutely want a happy, employee base.
Right. And I've been in a couple of cars where the driver works for both Uber and Lyft, and I've specifically asked them, what do you think about these two companies? And almost to the man, they say Uber is tough, antagonistic, we don't really feel welcome. And then they'll say, but Lyft is nicer.
I heard the same thing.
Yeah, they Lyft is at least trying to look out for us, trying to make our interactions with the company easier, blah, blah, blah. And that's why I think Uber will be history and Lyft may actually continue on towards the horizon.
Yeah, because you're right. I found the same thing, that by and large, the drivers speak more highly of Lyft than they do of Uber because, as you pointed out, Lyft is respectful to their people. At Micrel, the company I ran for 37 years, we were an employee-centric company. We focused on the employees. They were our bread and butter. They were what makes a company successful are the employees. And so we had a culture of honesty, integrity, respect for every individual, irrespective of their position. And the fourth was doing whatever it takes, no excuses. So those four cultures really are the mainstay of how we kept our employee turnover at the lowest in the industry, by far the lowest. The industry average was like 15% or 16%, and we were down below 7 for 37 years, 7% turnover. And so that's key. And we also had the highest boomerang rate in employees returning back to the company that left, the highest. I would say in the 37 years, half the employees that left the company wanted to come back. And that just speaks volumes for the culture that we had.
That does speak volumes because, like everyone else my age, I've had several jobs. And I cannot think of a single company that I wanted to go back to.
Really?
And so you had that many employees who said, please let me back in the door. It says a lot about the culture that they want to come home.
that's key to a successful company, is having a happy and productive employee base. We always talk about how important productivity is, whether you're in accounting or whether you're in purchasing or manufacturing. Productivity is extremely important, because that's how you keep your costs down. That's how you lower your expenses, is by through productivity.
Right. Okay. So in terms of building an enduring business, number one, we had have enough cash to take you to profitability. Number two, have an employee-centric corporate culture. What would be number three on your list?
Well, the third is an extremely important one, to keep your product line fresh. Whether you're a company like Uber, or whether you're a company like Micrel, you know, or Boeing, or wherever, where you have, you know, a product line that will obsolete, you have to make sure that whether you're a service company in real estate or banking, or whether you're making widgets, you got to keep that service or that product line fresh, because there is obsolescence. So, whether it's the techniques that you use in selling a property as a real estate person, whether it's the updating of the technology you're using for your widget, if that product line is not kept fresh, you know, you're just going to see your business diminish. Even though, you know, if you're running a beauty salon and you have a good customer, retention, meaning your people keep coming back, you'll probably find it's because you're keeping your service fresh. In other words, you're doing something a little different. Maybe you're adding something to the service that you're providing. You always want to keep updating your product line. I know that, I have an iPhone and an iPad from Apple, and I'm constantly getting updates. And I began to wonder if it's because they did a crappy job when he introduced the product, or whether they're just keeping their product line fresh. You can tell how good a company is by how fresh they keep their product and service.
Well, you know, there's a parallel which I can talk about a little bit. I've got like one tiny little toehold in the music industry. And with streaming now, and with the cost of entry being so low, it's completely changed the mechanics of how independent artists get out mm-hmm. to their audience. And a truism in their market is that you release an album once a year, maybe even longer. But you got to drop a single every couple of 2 months in order to keep your audience aware that you exist.
Exactly.
And by keeping them aware, when you do drop that big album, then they're ready to buy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's true in almost anything, whether you're in the music industry, beauty salon, or a banking, or making a widget of some kind. If you're running into a buggy whip type business, meaning the buggy whip is running out of style, out of business, you're soon gonna perish. Look at all the stores. I heard that Macy's is going to shut down hundreds and hundreds of stores. And I had to ask myself, I wonder why Macy's is having to close down so many stores. Same thing with Fry's Electronics. They're shutting down a lot of stores. Even though it should be obvious to them that online is taking over, they have to find a way to keep their product line fresh. Walmart, for example, is now moving into doing what Amazon's doing. So they are keeping their product line fresh. And then now some of these other grocery stores are now offering service, so that they'll deliver it to you, maybe using robots or whatever. But they're going to they're jumping in line. If you don't get in line, if you don't keep that product line fresh, you're going to die. And what Macy's has not been able to do is figure out how they're going to compete with online shopping.
Well, you know, while we're on this topic about keeping things fresh, give me a little bit of backstory here. You were in the semiconductor industry. This is always a place where there's continuous innovation going on, trying to anticipate where end products may be going in the future. What kind of things did you do in semis to try to keep product lines fresh in that kind of hyper-dynamic environment?
Well, every product has a life. I don't care whether you're doing making a shampoo or whether you're making iPhones. There is a certain life that you have to look for, that be aware of. In our industry, in the high-tech industry, your product is going to need to be refreshed at least every 5 years. And so they bring an iPhone out every year. And it's hard for them to figure out, okay, what are we going to do uniquely different? And that's a real struggle. Apple's having a real struggle trying to find how they keep that product line fresh. How do we keep people wanting to buy another iPhone? You know, they look at the battery life and they say, well, you know, battery life from the iPhone is probably 3 to 4 years. And so they know that at some point, the customer's going to have to get another phone. And to get them wanting to come back to Apple, we got to have something unique and different so that they don't go over to Samsung or LG or someone else. And so you have to look out ahead. You got to look ahead. Say, okay, what is the next? Where is this thing evolving? Where is it going? And be prepared for it. For example, when we were at Micrel, we knew that at some point the keypad on the cell phone was going to go away, because back in the early 90s, they brought cell phones out. All of them had keypads. Well, customers, you know, that makes the phone bigger. And if you remember the first, some of you may not even remember them, but they look like a big brick. Yeah. And you couldn't carry them in your pocket. You know, you had to put them in some kind of a holster or something. And so they said, okay, we're going to have to get rid of that keypad. And so to do that, I'm going to have to go to touch screen. So then you have to develop the technology to allow you to do touchscreen input. So we start out with a very tiny display. The display is probably an inch by an inch and a half, and people could hardly read them. And so they couldn't do much with them. So they knew the technology was going to go to more app-oriented technology as opposed just to being a cell phone or just a calling device. And so we need a bigger display. So we had to work on how do we build bigger screens, and how do we house them? How do we fabricate them? And people don't like great big thick things; they like them thin. If you note that the cell phone is actually bigger physically in a screen point of view than they ever have been, and yet the phone is thin, very very thin. TV monitors are very very thin. Screens are thin. And so, you know, we have to keep looking ahead and say, where is it all going? Well, thin is in, okay, as they say. And so, you know, you got to focus, okay, what can I do to innovate to make mine even thinner? And so I see the day, honestly, when the cell phone will be as thin as a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, what has my attention right now is artificial intelligence at a chip level. I perceive that there's going to be a future where AI is on the edge. It's in your cell phone. And it's kind of like what the internet was, a couple of decades ago. We know it's there. We know it's possible. We just have no idea what it's going to morph into. And I think once these AI chips find their way in the phones, there's going to be a whole new rush of innovation in terms of how we can make these so-called smart devices really smart devices.
Well, they're getting smarter. I mean, what limits the artificial intelligence is the speed of the microprocessor. And so as those can do things quicker and do it as fast as the human brain, then there's a lot of things we can do that are anticipatory. When somebody throws a ball, you're playing pitching a ball back and forth, even though you don't realize this, your brain recognizes that somebody is raising their arm to throw the ball. And so you're getting ready. Okay. And so that's your brain is a fantastic artificial intelligence tool because it sees in advance what you're about to do. So as AI can recognize well in advance something that needs to take place, then it can anticipate what to do. And so you'll see AI in everything. I mean, artificial intelligence will be in every aspect of our life, whether it be robots or whether it be cell phones or planes or, you know, and everything in our daily life is all going to be affected by artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I don't share in the gloom and doom that some prognosticators have. I think it's actually going to end up being such a huge accelerant to the human condition that we have our best days ahead of us, not any huge fear of everyone being chronically unemployed.
Well, I mean, that's what's been the problem since day one is they figured that AI is going to take over jobs. It will eliminate certain jobs, but allows that individual then to do another kind of a job. So AI then opens up doors as opposed to closing doors.
Well, and I, you know, on that point, one thing which I've been doing in some of my, you know, presentations lately is talking about what it was like when I first entered the business world. I mean, for me to get a report out when I was first out of college, I had to take material to the typing pool. I had to take my spreadsheet stuff out to somebody who could do typesetting. I then had to go over to the graphics department so somebody could draw me a pie chart. And then I had to take it to the mail room so that, you know, this report got put in everyone's cubicle folders. All of those jobs have gone away because my computer now allows me to do all of that work and then email it to everyone directly. But the unemployment rate didn't go up because of that. People found different opportunities, different ways to work, different things to do. And AI will have that same effect. It will, as you say, eliminate some jobs, but it doesn't eliminate opportunity. If anything, it's probably going to create some.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, go back to the cameras. You know, we used to have these film cartridges we'd put in the camera, and then you'd take the pictures. You usually take like three pictures because you wouldn't be able to see them until you went to get them developed. But then, so you took the once you ran all through all, you know, X number of pictures on the roll, I think it's 35 or whatever it was you used to take pictures of. You take that roll down to the local processor, then they would develop the pictures, and that used to take a few days, and then you'd go look at them and you decide what you wanted. And, you know, so when you shot a picture, you didn't actually get to see that picture maybe for a few months. Because, you know, you got to use up the whole roll unless you wanted to waste a roll. And so we're all, you know, programmed to use everything on the roll. So we'd have to, I mean, I've been literally a year back, you know, in the 50s and 60s, a year waiting to look at a picture that I took because, you know, I had to use up the roll and then I had to get it developed and so forth. Whereas now, need to take a picture of something to show somebody that this got broken and can you repair it? And, you know, I just take a picture of it and I can go down to the store and say, oh, I need this part. And, you know, it's instantaneous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, while the film companies have gone out of business, you know, that make the film, not gone out of business particularly, but when they no longer have that product line, that opened the door for a lot of other opportunities now. Because we can take pictures on the fly. So that's called refreshing your product line.
There we go. So before we recap these three tough things that people need to do for an enduring business in order to get a real quick start on your enduring business, do buy a copy of Tough Things First. This is Ray's Management and Leadership Manifesto. There is no single book that you can read that's going to make you better prepared for starting your business than this. And, you know, I've got a degree in management. I suck down business books on a regular basis. This is the top one. This is the one that entrepreneurs really need not only to read, but to hold close to their heart because it sets the foundation for doing it right. No pie in the sky, overhyped, you know, management theory. This is all boots on the ground, hard-nosed, what you need to do to build an enduring business guidance. And you can't get it from any source better than the longest serving CEO in Silicon Valley.
So just to recap, Guy, you know, the series that we're doing is really based on what they can find in Tough Things First. We're going to talk about the top three things that you need to do, tough things, top three tough things first you need to do in each particular area that we focus on in the book. And this is going to be a whole series of podcasts that are derived from what you can learn in the book.
Absolutely. And we're releasing them slowly. We're not going to give them to you all at once. We have other podcast guests, other topics that we're going to do, but this is going to be kind of your toehold into business reality, how to make it happen by facing down those things that people often don't like to face down. And if you don't face down these problems, then, you know, your business is going to be hampered, if not killed off entirely.
And if you if you finish the series that we're going to do on tough things first, you're going to get a certificate from us that'll show you have completed the tough things first a series of podcasts. So, you know, be the first to get a certificate saying that you have completed it. Maybe you can use it to get a raise at your particular company or to help you start a company, whatever. But say, I've been through the Tough Things First series podcast.
Well, now you got me thinking this needs to be a lecture series that we charge an admission fee for. Okay, so let's recap the top three tough things first that you need to do to build an enduring business. Looking at my notes here, number one I saw was have enough cash to take you to profitability and avoid all that money hunt, you know, going through the multiple rounds of fundraising. Have an employee-centric corporate culture, one that makes employees love the company and excited to show up to work every day. And keep your product line fresh so that you are ahead of the competition, ahead of the curve, always delighting your customers.
Exactly. So just rehearsing those again, raise enough money before you start. Number two is a happy a bunch is a happy lunch, you know, all your employees. And the third is, you know, we all like fresh vegetables, so keep your product line fresh.
There we go. Well, thanks, Ray. It is always enjoyable to get these lessons in business and life from you. And for your audience out there, tune in next week for another episode of Tough Things First, and we will continue educating you every week.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.